Welcome to the Home Health Revealed podcast, brought to you by HealthRev Partners. Join your hosts, Michael Greenlee and me, Hannah Vale, as we dive into the world of home health, hospice, and palliative care services. Each episode features real stories and insights from industry leaders covering everything from innovative technologies and payer negotiations to quality improvement and clinician safety. Whether you're a seasoned professional or new to the field, our podcast offers valuable knowledge to help you provide the best care for your patients. Tune in and be part of the conversation on Home Health Revealed. Welcome to today's episode of Home Health Revealed. I am your host, Hannah Vale. Michael Greenlee is not able to join us today, but that's okay. You're tuning in with just us girls. I'm excited to welcome Sarah Nigro, VP of Partnerships at BetterRx, and Courtney Tonks, Director of Nursing for Ovation Hospice and Hospice Consultant for BetterRx. And in this episode, we are going to explore the innovative new HOPE assessment tool designed to enhance hospice care. There is a handout available, and I will be sure to link it in the show notes. And then please be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can see the video of this episode, or follow us on your favorite platform so that you stay up to date on what's happening within the home health, hospice, and palliative care world. Today, we are going to talk about how the HOPE assessment tool provides a holistic view of patient needs, addressing physical, emotional, spiritual, and social aspects of care. Sarah and Courtney are going to share insights on the implications for hospice agencies and how it can improve care coordination among healthcare teams. So join us as we dive into how the HOPE assessment tool is set to transform the hospice care landscape and ensure that patients receive the individualized attention they deserve. Let's get started.
And the name of this presentation is HOPE is on the way. I can't wait for us to dive in. Sarah, Courtney, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hannah. Yeah, happy to be here.
So tell us what's coming. What can we expect? I know there's a lot of buzz around the new HOPE tool, and CMS has put out just enough to keep us interested. So talk to us about where we're going to go.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again. We're excited to talk about HOPE. So many agencies are unaware of what HOPE is going to do for their agency, what HOPE is going to do for the hospice care industry as a whole. And so hopefully today we can just give everybody a clear understanding of what the HOPE assessment is, what some of these key changes are, and understanding how implementation for the HOPE assessment is going to be rolled out by CMS and what that direct impact is for the agency, caregivers, and ultimately the patient. So that's really the goal for today. Lots of information is still being processed and shared. They're in beta right now with a few agencies. So as we all continue to learn, we'll be sure to pass resources along. Just starting high level with a little bit more about the HOPE assessment. So this is how it's defined by CMS. It's the Hospice Outcomes Patient Evaluation Assessment. And it's a tool that's going to start to holistically represent what the patient is going through on their journey in hospice by providing a little bit more of that real-time response rate and active assessment that will get a clearer picture as an industry of how patient care is evolving through hospice. And ideally, agencies will follow the HOPE assessment because it does directly, impact their reimbursement rates.
I love that they're taking the approach holistically instead of focusing so much on the medical side or the clinical side, right? They're bringing in a lot more focus for the IDG team.
And what's great about the HOPE assessment is that it was created with multiple perspectives. So it does create a more balanced perspective on the patient care journey. Doctors, nurses, other healthcare workers, social workers, all coming together to really assess how the patient is currently impacted and how they're being reviewed, and then just opportunities for improving that care. So again, this will continue to evolve, but where we are today is a step forward into better patient care. Courtney, I know this kind of rings true to you in your day-to-day.
Absolutely. I love that we're breaking it down into why it's so important. We're focused always on the patient first. But I love that they're really trying to get the hospice care teams to focus on the patient individually. It's not so much about a diagnosis anymore, right? Like, okay, CHFers, you've got these five things you have to focus on. They really want individualized care plans for these people. Yes, they might have congestive heart failure, but this patient may present differently than the other three patients you have. So I love that it's so patient-centered. Improving care coordination, we're kind of forcing these IDG groups to do exactly what we have been supposed to be doing the whole time, talking to each other, developing care plans all together, where a care plan from a nurse is going to be supported by the social work and chaplain's care plans, so that they all are working together for the benefit of the patient, instead of each individual discipline going out separately, developing care plans separately, and not talking about how they can all work to improve the patient's life for the time they have left. Quality improvement, as a former VP of quality, quality is like my dream. Let's give me the 5-star ratings. Please tell me how to do it. I am gonna do it. Let's prove that we're the best. If I believe that we're the best, then let's prove it. So anyone that is really driven by metrics, this is also going to help them hit those core measures while also focusing on the patient, identifying what needs to be improved. And again, going back to what Sarah said earlier, it's real time. So you get these metrics before the patient passes. So you know what you need to do. You're reporting before the patient passes, right? So you get to know, hey, we got to improve in these two areas, but we did great here. And then obviously regulatory compliance. We are working with the federal government here, Medicare dollars. It's not a little thing. And so they have to be sure that the care that's being provided is up to standard. And this assessment is going to allow us those, again, those metrics to ensure that these agencies that are claiming these benefits for these patients, that their dollars are being used appropriately.
What we've spoken about before is the level of fraud and just kind of industry abuse. Yeah. A lot of the HOPE assessment will bring just that visibility into caring for the entire patient and not letting it just be reliant on who they come in as based on their medical records. It's truly assessing the person that you have right in front of you and what their diagnosis is that got them into hospice and how you can care for them during this few months of their life. And so hopefully this does draw a lot more attention to the patient journey so that also the caregivers that are seeing this care happen, like, it's motivating for them. It makes them feel like they've made the best decision for their loved one.
For sure.
By placing them into that hospice care. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love how on that slide before, and you don't have to go back, but you put in that it builds that trust. And I think anytime you have everybody on the same page, your care team together, and they are working with the entire family, working with the entire patient, it's going to build trust. They're going to have more confidence in what's going on, more confidence in the end of their life really being fulfilled and lived out to the fullest.
The thing that I love about it is your admission nurse, a lot of agencies have an admission nurse, right? And so they're sending the nurse out just to do the admits. This is forcing a follow-up visit, and it's not a bad thing, but ultimately that nurse that's going to do the follow-up visit should be the nurse that this patient is building that trust with. And so you have from the time of care and the time that it's initiated, that face that you're learning to trust for the last days in your life. And then on top of that, you have a care team that's coming in to enforce what the nurse is already following up on. So yeah, it really does give better opportunity for that trust.
Just jumping into what really constitutes as the differentiators for the HOPE assessment, it is comprised of 4 key elements of assessing physical needs, emotional needs, spiritual needs, and social needs. I know, Courtney, based on all of your experience, you had specific examples for each of these buckets that truly does center the care around that, which is really exciting.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, physical needs is obviously what hospices are built to focus on, right? We're putting somebody on hospice most of the time because there is an uncontrolled physical need, whether that is pain, whether that is cancers growing, whether that is they are, they're falling all the time, right? There are signs of physical decline that a doctor's recognizing and saying, hey, we think that they're ready. And so that should be addressed every visit by your nurse, right? At admission, they're also going to be looking at the emotional needs. Is this patient coping okay? I mean, it's hard to be told you've got a terminal diagnosis, right? You're not going to make it through this. We can't treat this anymore. And so a nurse is also going to help focus on those emotional needs and be that safety, that trust. But that also gets to bring in a social worker, and that also gets to bring in a chaplain. And so I'm finding that a lot of this is going to allow the nurse to do a lot of education with these patients, because oftentimes they don't understand, I don't need a chaplain, right? Like, I have my religious leader in my life. I don't need a chaplain, or I'm not spiritual at all. And that's okay. But what the hospice chaplain can do is simply be a listening ear. And so it's a great opportunity for the nurse to really educate on, hey, for our team to work the very best, let's let these visitors come. If you hate it after the first time, let me know. But it really gives them an opportunity to help develop trust there. And then, like I said, it leads into those spiritual needs, the resources, okay, you haven't been in touch with your parish or your ward or, you know, your area church. Like, let me help you. Let's reach out to them. Let's get a visitor coming. So it really does lend itself to finding resources outside of the hospice team if it's needed. And then the social needs, right? How many patients that need hospice, they don't have a POA in place and they need help and they don't know how to start? Or a living will. What do I do when I'm gone? I don't have that done. As well as, hey, I got to get on this new choice waiver because I need to get into a skilled nursing facility. I have no one to care for me. And so your social worker gets to come in and kind of help mentor, guide, and lead those processes so that the nurse can then go back to focusing on those physical and emotional needs. So it really, I love that it's this continuum, right? And that we get to focus on that continuum now.
Well said. And we presented this in person recently. We had some people sharing really interesting just experiences from admission in regards to the spiritual needs. So I'm glad that you were talking just about how that can vary. It doesn't have to be necessarily that a chaplain is going in there from a religious standpoint, but correct, it's more of that, you know, just like person to confide in, and whether it's just a calming presence or somebody to help guide you spiritually or emotionally, that is so important. And one of the agencies mentioned that they could not get people to really agree to having the chaplain come because the area that they're in doesn't necessarily represent a more religious community. Yep. And so they actually started to send the chaplain with the admissions nurse, and their ratings and responses for improvement and acceptability like went up a drastic amount. And it was not that they were forcing in any way this person on people, but just having them show up and be like, hey, I'm here, you know, get to know me. And they loved that individual so much. So it really helped improve their philosophy of care as an agency. Yeah, and when they're getting that person out to patients. So, you know, I think a good takeaway from this section is that it's always smart to rework your kind of the lineup of events taking place for treatment and for assessment. Like, if you're seeing that people are saying no to the chaplain, do something to test out what that barrier is. And ultimately, yeah, you might be surprised that people are more accepting of a more spiritual presence, if you will.
Yeah. So I know somebody mentioned in that session, Sarah, that they had just changed the name. They quit calling him a chaplain. I think they called them a spiritual care coordinator or something of that nature. And maybe the name chaplain rang something that they didn't, you know, they felt like they weren't equipped to deal with. I don't know. But the name change alone seemed to make a difference for that particular agency who mentioned it.
So. Yeah. I mean, I look at the things that my chaplain's been able to do. One of these was a patient I actually was case managing. And this little lady was grumpy. And she had dementia real bad. And she was also a very big princess. So her wig was on every day. She was done up to the nines and she was sick. And she didn't want anybody visiting. And I brought the chaplain in with me for a visit and they started to develop a friendship. I started to develop a friendship with this lady, right? She didn't know my name, but she remembered my face, same as my chaplain's. And my chaplain was able to, the timing of this was fascinating. We were able to nail down a photographer and get a letter from the governor. She had served in the Supreme Court in the state of Utah at one point or another, thanking her for her service. And she got a photo shoot. And then about about 4 or 5 days later, this sweet thing transitioned. But my chaplain was able to pull off this miracle day where she just smiled to the nines, and this woman did not smile. And that's the thing that the chaplain can do, right? Really pull out, like, what's important to you? How do you need to feel fulfilled? What's holding you back? And identify those things and figure out a way to give them the closure that they need so that their spirits, their souls, whatever word you want to use to describe your inner self is at peace with your life, with the things that you've experienced. And so it does not have to necessarily be religious, right? That wasn't a religious experience, but we knew that was holding her back, to feel like she was so stuck on, I did all of these things, but I'm stuck in this facility, right? And so finding a way to give closure in one way or another.
I love that you use the word closure. I was talking to a chaplain recently who talked about the need for forgiveness at the end of life, whether that's forgiving yourself, forgiving others, but walking through grief process yourself with that existential crisis, knowing things are coming to a close, dealing with levels of regret, relationship trials, anything that you need as that whole person to be able to tie up the bow of the gift of your life. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal. And so if you're only looking at those physical needs, then you're not addressing. And those can also present as physical needs, right? Yes. There's restlessness. There's things that come with this. And mm-hmm. I'm not clinical, so I'm not, you know, able to probably articulate this as well as you probably could. But we know how those, I mean, even a stressed or anxious day for myself, how that presents physically for me, right? That's on a whole nother level. And so coming to that level of closure can present in other ways. And so it's so important. And I love that about this HOPE tool, that just as a human being to another human being, we're looking at you as an entire person. And how can we really meet you where you are?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. I love that.
Okay. So talking through what is the kind of quality measure that's being assessed for HOPE. So if it's timeliness of pain management and pain impact, and then timely reassessment of symptom follow-up impact. And the way that this will be broken down is these hospice update visits will be in addition to any of your admission, any of your routine visits. So these are two net new visits. And then out of them, it's really determining if there's a symptom follow-up visit that needs to be on the calendar as well. So a lot of agencies have implemented this already. Courtney has spoken to this for a long time because in her experience, the philosophy of care should be treating the whole patient and implementing, you know, however many visits it takes to make sure that that person is comfortable. We've also heard on the other end of this, agencies that are really short-staffed or that are really going to feel this, these additional visits on their schedule. And so just kind of base awareness of what's being assessed from this is truly, it's not optional. It shouldn't be optional because you're assessing the level of comfort of your hospice patient, which in turn really is the hospice benefit, you know, ensuring that comfortable and dignified passing. And so those are just two of the quality measures.
I just like the key word here being timely. I think that Medicare has identified some things that in my, I don't even know how many years of experience in this industry now, that I see where it's like pain is almost expected, right? And so it's not treated as urgent. But when you think about it, these patients, they sometimes all they can do is sit and think about when they're going to die. And then they're in pain. And so I really love that Medicare's like, sure, you might be assessing pain once a week, but that's not timely. Sitting for 6 days with a pain level of 7 out of 10, that's not fair. And it's not okay. And that's the opposite of what hospice is focused on. I think there's also this weird dichotomy with nurses right now where it's like, they're using too many narcotics, or they're going to get addicted. Because you hear the other side when you come from acute care in the hospital, in the ER, anyone that's saying, hey, I'm in pain, you have to take a step back and look at it. And hospice is very different. If we're saying this patient is passing and they're terminally ill, the first thing we should do is, how can we get you comfortable? And as a nurse, obviously pain is numero uno there. And so I really love that Medicare's like, hey guys, addressing pain once a week isn't really enough, especially if their pain's high. So you got to show that you're doing exactly what we need you to do by getting meds out timely, by talking to your doctor and coordinating and adjusting and by managing these symptoms.
And something that really hit home for me recently is understanding that this person is still alive. You know, a lot of times when we talk about hospice, it's in regard to their transition and how they're going to pass and kind of that preparation. But I love stories you've shared about, you know, making sure that the patient is taken care of, has you guys have these miracle days, but it's treating somebody like they're living and taking care of them while they're alive. And the risk of addiction from pain management medication is such a reduced risk compared to them passing in pain or some of these other drugs that are, you know, potentially more harmful to them in certain situations, reactions, or, you know, their risk being on a blood thinner and falling and bleeding out from that versus like, take care of your patient, make sure that they're comfortable. This is a temporary situation for this person. And then again, just kind of going back to some of the brass tacks of HOPE data. So data is starting to be collected right now with a couple beta agencies. So once this rolls out for the nation on October 1st, 2025, so under a year at this point, it will not directly, you know, impact them. They won't see these reactions from their scoring or public reporting for a little while. So that data will be captured and then they'll be starting to see that coming out in fiscal year 2028. So again, like it's really important to get ahead of this and start to implement some of these strategies so that come October 1st, the agency is not caught off guard, that care teams understand what is being asked of them and that they can properly prepare for whatever impact this is going to have to their current you know, philosophy of care and also their just day-to-day like staffing issues. Again, like star ratings are the number one that are going to be assessed, you know, as a result of the care that you provide a patient. So making sure that this introduction is actually helpful to your team, you know, getting them on webinars, getting them trained up, reading the guide that Medicare put out, I think can only help. And this will replace the current hospice item set, so HIS. So instead of it just being, you know, that admission or discharge information, it's throughout the whole first 30 days really of a patient's journey in hospice.
Yeah. And then the discharge, right? I feel like hospice obviously is going to also focus on, did they pass appropriately and peacefully? And did you feel okay about the process? I feel like now, right, you amp up all of your visits at the beginning. We were talking about how many visits a hospice patient can potentially have when they're admitted. And you think about it now with these update visits, the nurse is supposed to be back, what, 2 days later? So that's two visits in the first 3 days of care from a nurse. Then you add in the hospice aide, then you add in chaplain and social worker, and hey, maybe a volunteer's in there too. I mean, you're seeing them a lot in those first 7 days of care. And then the last 5 days of their life, you're also going to see, we're going to really amp up, right? The SIA visits. We are going to increase our frequencies and we're really going to show up again for the patient when it matters.
Yeah. So this is just a little bit more about implementation and compliance. So again, everything's officially taking effect October 1st of 2025, and it will require that agencies submit their data within a 30-day range of these events taking place. So timeliness of, you know, admission, timeliness of assessment, all of that's going to be really important to log for, you know, the actual reimbursement. So the way that this is going to work, if you're not meeting that 30-day time period for data submission, and you fail to meet 90% of that, you will be reduced in your reimbursement. So it is a direct hit to the bottom line. So making sure that you're following in terms of these timelines that they're giving us will be very important just for your reimbursement perspective.
And we kind of hit this assessment schedule, but again, right, your admission nurse is going out. Sometimes that's accompanied, like you said, by that agency that said the chaplain came. I've worked with an agency where the social worker came. I mean, there's lots of different ways, but for all intents and purposes, a comprehensive assessment by a nurse has to be done at hospice admission, right? Symptoms, what we're putting them on with the terminal diagnosis. It is a clinical admission. And then you have 5 days after that admission to bring in all of your other disciplines to get their assessment in. So the first 5 days of care are really crucial. And then you have these nursing update visits or symptom management, and it's one between 6 and 15 are just those update visits. But then the symptom follow-up, it's not the next day, it's 2 days, right? I think is what their measurement was. Yeah. And that's the symptom follow-up visit for the moderate or severe symptoms that are uncontrolled. Mm-hmm. So it really does kind of change this assessment schedule. So where we just talked about how intense it could be in the first 7 days, you're adding another 2 or 3 nursing visits potentially within that first 10 days of care.
It's definitely an impact. I do think it's worth noting, because previously I had understood that it would always have to be a nurse. For the symptom follow-up visits, it is a nurse or an LPN. If they do have an LPN, that person would be able to go out to that patient and continue to check on them from that pain management situation. But it is cumbersome for the care team, especially amidst the nursing kind of shortage we have.
Can you talk a little bit about the moderate or severe pain or uncontrolled symptoms, like based on the rating scale and who gets to say whether those are moderate or severe?
Absolutely. That's going to be your admission nurse, right? So you go out, and I find a lot of hospice patients are like the really stubborn, very stoic older men who have lived very long lives. They are independent and they do not want someone up in their business. And so they will often deny pain or say it's a 2 when you can see on their face that they're really tight and every move they make, they're kind of grimacing. And so you have to use your best nursing judgment, but a moderate pain rating for me would be anything at a 4 to a 7, right? In that range, you're moderate. 7 to 10, your severe pain. We get to use a lot of pain assessment tools as a nurse. There's a FACES tool. There's a verbal scale. There's all of the nonverbal signs, right? Like, we really have to kind of be a detective with a lot of these patients, especially at admission, because like we've talked about, that trust isn't built yet. So that patient is going to be like, I have denied that I've been in severe pain for a long time. And why would a stranger coming into my house change that now? But I found 4 weeks after I've been seeing this patient twice a week and they get to know me and I'm spending time, that now finally they're like, hey, I'm actually not sleeping very well because my back, it really hurts. So at assessment, the nurse has to be a little bit more inclined to be a bit of a detective. The other symptoms, we've got shortness of breath, right? That's a huge one in hospice. We're going out on a COPD-er, they can't breathe, their lungs don't expand. They can't move without huffing and puffing, right? A walk to the bathroom is like a 2-day hike for us. And so that would be a severe symptom that I would say, hey, we got to get back there. Is the morphine helping? Is the lorazepam helping? Did the oxygen concentrator get there? And is the flow being set at the appropriate rate? Those are the first two that I think for hospice teams and nurses, they're really going to be focused on as far as symptoms and pain.
Yeah, it does take a lot of time for people to open up. And often in hospice, there is so much like stigma to get over at that first admission. So I do think the hospice update visits create that other opportunity for a patient to disclose how they truly are, and to now see that patient again as somebody that's on hospice. They've, you know, had some of these other agency workers come out and actually help them understand the level of care that they're going to receive. And so hopefully at that first HUV visit, people are starting to get more of that care that they need from a pain management perspective. Mm-hmm. We've kind of gone over this, so I'm going to skip ahead if that's okay, and just into a visual of what these data collection time points look like. This is based off of that 30-day scale that you can see, you know, and Courtney, you walked through this verbally, but just seeing these, you know, different meeting points, knowing what this is going to impact, you know, your day-to-day business. And we talked a lot about the EMRs. The EMRs and the EHRs really need to do their part to update their systems to not only reflect what's going on with Hope, but to help with managing some of these schedules. Because if somebody is not now proactively putting it on there to block another opportunity for that meeting for a nurse or a symptom follow-up visit, this will get ahead of us really quickly, especially for some of the larger agencies.
Absolutely. They'll miss those markers, not because they aren't thinking about the patient. They're just not familiar. This is going to change their schedule quite a bit.
So making sure that we hit on some of the larger ticket items, like the symptom follow-up visits. You know, you did ask a really great question, Hannah, just in regards to what constitutes moderate or severe. Mm-hmm. And something that we chatted with agencies in the room was making sure that they're reassessing what their scale is so that everybody's on the same page, whether it's ESAS or some of those like facial cue measure models, just making sure that everybody understands what moderate and what severe is so that it's not in any way open to interpretation. And there are guidelines now within this tool that will help everybody kind of stay on the same page about what that level measurement should be.
And you know what I just saw on this slide that I probably misspoke earlier was that it can occur on the same day, which I actually really like. We do a 24-hour follow-up visit after admission, which I feel like that's just an idea that another agency had, and I kind of implemented it and I've ran with it in my career. But I found that coming the next day, hospice is like five fire hoses at someone's face and their family's face. And it's a lot of information. And oftentimes you give them the 24/7 number five times and they still feel like they can't call. And so going the next day to reestablish, like, hey, we're still here. We're not going anywhere. Hey, remember when I asked you about your pain and I got those medicines out last night? Have you had a chance to use those? Hey, that morphine and lorazepam that was delivered. Let's talk about those. Those are big drugs and they scare a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, are we starting you at a lower dose? This is why we like morphine. It doesn't just treat pain. It opens. It's a vasodilator. It's going to open up your blood vessels and allow oxygen to flow better. That's why we like it for shortness of breath. You're going to breathe easier. And a lot of people don't know that. With a lighter dose of morphine for shortness of breath, honestly, it does the trick. And patients are so afraid because there's such a bad stigma. So these follow-up visits, I just think are going to lead to more success for the patient. And again, that's the whole goal. But it's going to lead to a more empowered terminal patient.
Yeah. That's and awesome. It just goes back to building that trust, right? That we talked about before. Yes, I'm still here. 24 hours later, still here
exactly.
for you.
Yep.
Yeah. And so this is what a snapshot of what it's actually going to look like for this tool, for this clinical assessment, where you're going to rank their code for pain, shortness of breath, anxiety, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, or agitation. These are great things to be measuring. And so I know a lot of EMRs have some of this built in for like shortness of breath, anxiety, things like that. But just, you know, now is the time for these agencies to reach out to their EMR, EHR, and really finding out like what their plan is to support their agency, if there's going to be trainings, if there's, you know, anything that they can take advantage of.
Yeah. And then again, can we go real quick right back to that slide? I just have, so I spoke to pain and shortness of breath, which is the top of their list, right? I really love that they're focusing also and adding anxiety and agitation. I think that oftentimes in our terminal patients, it's just not understood, right? Because if they're falling 10 times in 2 days, that's agitation. Something's going on. And so I love that Medicare's like, hey, we got to bring attention to this because you have things that you can do to help and fix and make them comfortable. And being anxious all of the time, I don't know if any of you are anxious people. I am. It's miserable. You can't rest. You can't eat. Your bowels go crazy. So I love that they're focusing on the continuum here as well.
Yeah. Well, and it really kind of goes back to, I would say in the last 5 years, people have gotten so much more open about their mental health and talking about it and treating it. And so it's only natural that this will continue throughout somebody's life, especially if they have a history of it. But even assessing somebody from net new, like somebody that's never had anxiety before, could present anxiety in their hospice journey, because again, they're navigating so much. Like, this is a really emotional time. Yeah. We also, I think, at least for me, I'm not clinical and I don't work at a hospice. You know, one thing that we all share in common is that we're all going to pass at some point. We're all born and we're all going to die, right? And so assessing that really can happen at an earlier phase for people in their life. And so taking into consideration just how much angst and anxiety and emotional turmoil that can bring for maybe, you know, a mother with young kids or a father with, you know, just a lot of responsibilities, a child. So just assessing that it's not always just the elderly population
for sure.
That's being represented in these assessments.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I have a patient that I will never forget, right? 35-year-old mom of 3 little boys. And she was one of my best friends by the time she passed, by the amount of time that I spent in her home and just that relationship that we had to build. And this tool would have, not that we didn't treat her anxiety and her agitation, but that really did play into her journey. Those 3 boys without their mom was really hard for her to face, that she was letting them down and she was hurting them. And so being able to bring that in for all of our patients is really a huge and helpful thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that, because you're right. Like, this will be such a game changer in tracking the assessment of it. Like, imagine in a couple of years now, if we're seeing that this code has been entered time and time again, that people are reporting that anxiety is at the very top of the list, and CMS has plans to improve upon it, or hospice is now taking a different focus on it. Like, this will do a lot of good for future generations and just future hospice care patients. A little bit more kind of a deep dive into that symptom follow-up visit, because again, these are really crucial. So after that hospice update visit takes place, within 2 calendar days, if your patient has moderate or severe symptoms, you're back there with a nurse or an LPN, and then making sure that everything is logged properly within 30 days. So that as long as you're 90% compliant within that time frame, you're getting that 4% reimbursement.
You're gonna be okay.
This is kind of a scenario for a hospice patient within 30 days. So all of this is really centered around the first 30 days of care. If a patient is on service after 30 days, I think ideally you're getting in early to understand somebody's pain level, and that can dissipate throughout their time on hospice. It's really probably unlikely that it would, considering the state that they're in, but you're really cramming in a lot of visits early on. And then after that 30-day period, you would be required to have another, this would be considered a third hospice update visit and potentially a third symptom follow-up visit. And then they kind of don't have any more significance necessarily from a reimbursement standpoint. It becomes like, you know, to your hospice agency's preference of when you're showing up.
Until they pass. I just re-looked up the average length of stay, and it's actually only 70 days.
Okay.
I think that's the shocking part of hospice, is like, you're good for 6 months, right? So that's 180 days. We're missing the mark, right? Like, people are coming on a little late. They're not getting that full benefit, which I think this admission process of like all of these visits is really showing, hey, they are, we're symptom managing, we're adjusting medications. They are appropriate. And so I really do think it's going to help people learn, hey, they could probably have come on 2 months sooner when all of their blood pressure medicine was being titrated and adjusted and discontinued, and we started other things and they started not breathing well. You know, it'll help maybe providers even recognize this patient could go on to hospice services sooner.
Just from even a palliative care standpoint, or even from the referrals that you're earning these different, you know, most of these providers that are making the referrals into hospice are not hospice trained. And so their best guess of patient diagnosis and terminal illness is not rooted in the same treatment and diagnosis like structure as a hospice trained professional. And so there is that opportunity. Hopefully this presents that opportunity for more cross collaboration and more education for some of these physicians or referral sources for these agencies to help identify when it's most appropriate versus it being a little bit too late in some cases.
I mean, and even using this calendar for a primary care provider, showing them like, hey, you adjusted a medication for a patient that has, let's say, congestive heart failure. You have had them back in your office 3 times this week, adjusting and managing symptoms. Like, look at what these hospice visits look like. Maybe we should look at that. If you're adjusting them that frequently, maybe it's time to start talking to them about hospice, especially in a disease that's progressive and not going to get better.
And one of the things we talked about also in the presentation was determining length of stay. And so, Sarah, I know BetterRx has some partnerships and technology partners who really can play a part in that.
Absolutely. So, for example, from a predictive analytics standpoint, there's, you know, a system called Hospice Dynamics, and their accuracy is 180 days before a patient passes. It's 91%. And what they're really looking at is, how is this patient progressing based on their medical records? So it's pulling that data. I think it's over 360 fields of data from that EMR, EHR, that's really going to help determine the predicted length of stay for that patient. And so while many agencies collectively understand what their length of stay is, understanding that, again, this is by the individual, that predicted length of stay can help inform their care plan. It can help inform what their family's communication looks like, how they're preparing on some of these other facets that are non-physical. So the emotional, spiritual, and social needs that go into this assessment. So just being kind of open-minded to the fact that while you have data as an agency, there is so much more that you could be doing with some of the tools and technologies that are out there today to really make this experience more seamless for the patient and help inform your caregivers so that you're making more action-based decisions in real time versus reactive.
Yeah. Those are great points, because I think as we prepare for anything, anytime you take a deeper dive and a harder look at a process, it's an opportunity, right, for growth, for new education, for new ways of thinking and doing processes within your organization. So as you're looking at internal staffing and what you're going to do from a logistical and, you know, clinical, financial, operational perspective, you're also looking at those referral partners, like you mentioned. How can we better educate them, bring them into what we're doing, and make those relationships better and more informed, as well as looking at technology? I mean, you have to think about the part that technology can play when you're looking at the partnerships that you have, the tech stack that you're working with. Where can you maybe automate some of those or get some additional predictive analytics or some help in automation wherever you can, so that you can take your human capital and make it more patient facing, right? I think this is an opportunity for that 360 degree walk around where it's like, okay, let's take a good look and see where we can go as we're preparing for hope.
That is so well said. And truthfully, the agency that's going to stand out as a leader in this space is one that adopts technology and that they're early adopters, because even using the example of predictive analytics and predictive length of stay, if you're knowing what that PLOS data represents for your individual patients, now you're forecasting into what type of care you're going to need from your team from a staffing perspective. And of course, like, we're people at the end of the day, like, we can only measure what we can measure, and then the body's going to do what the body wants to do. But having a more tightened up plan is just, it's going to benefit from an operational standpoint for your team, which if your team is better prepared, if your team is better resourced, that's a better outcome for the patient.
And I know you mentioned even from a medication standpoint, right? If we know that this person's length of stay is not going to be 6 months, how can we conserve resources, allocate resources better, limit risk of having additional medications in the home, knowing they're likely not going to be used? How can we use that to better prepare the hospice agency?
Right. And specifically, the way that we are planning to use predicted length of stay from Hospice Dynamics is for that quantity count for hospice medications, but it also should be used as an indicator for, you know, let's not prescribe this antibiotic. It takes 6 weeks at minimum to kick in. This patient's going to be on service for an estimated length of stay of under 15 days. You know, let's go ahead and order that 15-day supply instead of 30 or a 90. In some cases, you know, agencies are really, they are more cost-focused than ever. Ancillary charges are out of control. Teams ordering behaviors, you know, it really depends on what they have access to. And so if there's anything that we as the vendors and the solution partners can do to help reduce their costs and also make sure that patient care isn't being sacrificed in any way, we want to do that. And we want to continue driving that innovation. So just kind of a quick overview of how the implementation will go for HOPE assessment. Just what this does to change an IDG meeting.
Yeah, I really love the care planning aspect. I think that's the biggest change, right? As nurses, we're in an EHR and the care plan is point and click. We're choosing an intervention and a goal that's the same as we've chosen for three other patients. We're clicking four of the same interventions. And this is quite truly asking for individualized care plans that if you're going out for moderate or severe symptom management, then that better be care planned. And we've got to have it look different than the other three patients that might have that same diagnosis, but they're not all dealing with the same things. And so the biggest takeaway is the IDG team approach gets to work collaboratively to develop those care plans. Instead of the nurse going out, writing her, this is the same care plan as the last three patients with CHF, it's sitting down with the team and saying, or sending information and saying, hey, I actually have got to add for this patient's falling, they're short of breath, and they're a huge risk for UTIs. That's what I'm going to do. Anything specific with the medical history, doc? Or I think with the falls, this is really hard for them emotionally. This is embarrassing. They're doing it in front of their family and they've been the strong provider their whole life, right? Those kinds of things. I think that's what I'm most excited about is care planning, individual and specific things that are not only diagnosis specific as they are now, but they're patient and all integrated together.
Definitely. That's the most exciting part. It makes so much sense. We need to treat people as they are, which is their people. I expect this. Like, this is the kind of care that I advocate for, that I'm interested in for my loved ones, for my future self. Yeah. It's really working to make this change so that the evolution of care works in our favor. Ultimately, you know, I want to live a really beautiful life and then be on hospice someday and be super comfortable and super well loved and cared for. And, you know, I think that the fact that we're kind of a little bit maybe behind on this, this is that opportunity to change. So it's exciting.
I think it's forcing collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I say that in the best way possible. That is not a negative thing, but really I talked to somebody the other day and they're like, every entity in my hospice agency is separate, right? My chaplain goes out. I don't know when they're going out. My social worker goes out. I don't know when they're going out. I don't know what they're working on. I'm going out as the nurse and my aide sometimes talks to me and my medical director just says, do whatever, right? Like so many things where it's just, we get into these routines of it's another patient, it's another day, and it's another CHFer, it's another cancer patient. When in reality, this is saying, no, it's a different patient. This is separate. We're all together now. We get to work together. When the chaplain goes out, they should be saying, hey, I identified this problem. Nurse, did you see that? Social worker, can you help me? What are your care plans that you're going to focus on? Because ultimately, they should all be supportive of each other.
Love that. Mic drop, literally. Yeah. Like, this will connect people.
Well, and the patient may share something with another member of the team.
Yeah.
That they may not share with someone else. And so it's important to transfer that information.
Not everyone loves a nurse, and that's okay. They've had a bad experience. My cute mom is sick and has been sick my whole life. And she was in the hospital one time for 3 weeks. And all she could tell me after that was about the one bad nurse she had. And it changed my whole perspective on being a nurse in general. Like, one bad nurse can impact somebody forever, where they don't trust a nurse that comes in, or they have a bad experience. I mean, it's that way with anybody we encounter, right? One bad experience can kind of ruin your taste for doctors or for contractors or, you know, whatever it might be.
And so,
exactly. Yeah. And so you think about that. Yeah. And if these patients have had a bad interaction with the nurse somewhere, a nurse walking in is not going to be what they want to see.
Yeah.
And so someone coming in that is safe and not going to bug them for vital signs and just wants to sit and chat probably will get to them on an emotional level sooner than the nurse will. They'll probably give them more. And so that collaboration is, it's so needed.
I did want to make mention, like, I listened to some podcasts. Obviously the Health Rev podcast is one of those, but this one was called the Hospice Nursing Podcast. And this nurse was sharing that it's so important for agencies to pick the right person for, you know, those admission visits, because ultimately it's a reflection of the whole agency. And just because you're going to an admission visit does not mean that you have earned that patient. And I always say earned because it's not a given, you know, that person, that family does not have to pick your hospice. So aligning, you know, who you have going out in the field to make those visits is important, because ultimately they're the ones carrying the torch for your agency and setting that standard of care.
Yeah.
And Sarah, before you start talking about the service intensity add-on, because I know as we're thinking about documentation, we're thinking about reimbursement, right? And claims, because the documentation, this new HOPE assessment tool is going to serve as your ticket, right? For what you get paid. And so, you know, for Health Rev Partners, our team is, you know, trying to seek out any information to make sure, because they're adding on these new domains to the HOPE assessment. And so if you want to partner with somebody like Health Rev to help with that transition, right? We have a team who would look through the documentation. Now, hospice pays on level of care, not on coding, but it's so important to have the proper coding so that it aligns with your clinical documentation so that your claim is not denied. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity for education. And when you work with somebody like Health Rev, you can do, you know, a short contract, even if it's just during that transition stage, to have that additional support to help your team walk through the changes. And, you know, people don't always know, they just think, oh, I don't want to get into a coding contract, and that's okay. But sometimes during these transitions, it's nice to have those experts on your side.
Definitely. Well, and just from what I know about Health Rev Partners specifically is that you all are, you know, you're making the best decision for the agency as well. You're truly coming in to help them with reimbursements, to help them find money that would have otherwise been lost because of poor documentation. And so understanding that you are coming in as more strategic counsel to their business as well is such a different approach. And so, you know, it never hurts to, you know, if a team needs help to reach out, because I know that they would be in good hands with you all. But also, like, this is going to be new for everybody. So I do think a lot of people are going to need help initially, you know, especially in that first year, that first couple of years, even leading up to 2027. So from 2025 to 2027, making sure that everything is locked up so that they're poised for the highest reimbursement that they can.
And thank you for saying that. I do really love our team.
Yeah. Good people.
Yes.
The service intensity add-on, like, is, you know, we've touched on it a little bit from Courtney, but just making sure that in that last week of care, you are so buttoned up with your approach, because ultimately what we talked about was, yes, you have somebody who maybe they've had a rough nursing experience in their past. You're helping overcompensate in some of those ways, but that last 2 weeks and 7 days specifically for how much care is being given to a patient will help you earn that service intensity add-on. So making sure that, you know, you're always thinking about your patient, but just doubling down in that last week of care so that they feel that, like, person hug.
Supporting when it matters, right?
Yep. We've kind of chatted through best practices for this, but ultimately it's the idea of more compassionate communication. And so that's what's really most exciting from My perspective about the HOPE assessment is that it gives that truthful opportunity with patients and families to have one-on-one attention. You always want to make sure that the needs are fully understood of the patient, their family, or any support system that they have, and utilizing feedback. So understanding how this implementation the assessment in general is going to impact care, communicating that proactively so that maybe people that, you know, are have been on service or have family members, that they understand what this new addition brings to them and the value that your agency is providing with the HOPE assessment, because it is a value add. Your best course of action is just to proactively prepare for this. If you can start to implement the hospice update visits now, if your team has that capacity, if you can leverage what's in the guide posted by CMS on their site, it's important to get ahead now, because this will roll out and you don't want to be overwhelmed. And how incredible, this will only benefit you, you know, higher star ratings, more better survey readiness and preparedness. So if you can take advantage of what's being published now and be an early adopter, you will be so much more successful come 2025.
Sure. I mean, I think it's worth noting too that your star ratings become your brand in the marketplace. As you're out there and people are looking for hospice care, those things are going to matter.
Well, and we all know about how star ratings really impact an agency financially. I would say much higher level of attention on agencies with a 3-star rating or below. They're really cracking down to enhance that level of care. This is one way to certainly do that through the HOPE assessment.
Absolutely.
Well, and we have all the resources here. One thing that I did want to mention that I do really hope people, you know, use is the email that Medicare has given us access to, because ultimately you're hearing it from us, we're taking it from CMS. Please go to the source. If you have questions, if something's not clear, or if you have a unique, you know, just kind of one-off that's not necessarily in that guide, please reach out to them, because this is that time to ask for help and instruction. And then, of course, give feedback as to how this is going to impact your business.
Yeah, I think it's important that we understand agencies, they're boots on the ground. Like, there's a difference in policy and practice. And so if you have use cases that you feel like are unique, that you feel like don't maybe fit the model, take the time to write it down, send the feedback to CMS, ask for clarification.
I think a lot of people live in fear of CMS a lot, right? Like, it's scary dealing with money maybe being taken back, but be proactive and use them as a resource. Don't be afraid to reach out.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point. So, well, thank you guys so, so much. I have appreciated you coming on here, talking through all these things that are coming down the pike. And it's always great to get to collaborate. It's great to get to talk with you guys as partners. BetterRx and HealthRev work hand in hand together and really align with their philosophy of care and value that we want to bring to the post-acute industry. And so it's an honor for me to get to have you on here, to get to hear your perspective, and just great time talking through the care we want to provide to these patients, because that's really what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And changing the perspective of hospice from maybe giving up hope to bringing hope and bringing fulfillment at the end of life. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.